Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is United States v. Martin. And however you arrange yourself to take these cases. Mr. Rowling, I guess you're first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Tim Rowling. I am one of the attorneys for Mr. Troy Martin. Mr. Martin has two issues in this case. He's joined the issue of a co-defendant. The issue I'm dealing with is the issue of the wiretaps in this case and the government's failure to seal and preserve certain recorded conversations and certain disks in this case. That is our position that that non-sealing and that losing of certain recordings essentially infected the indictment here from the time that it occurred all the way through, because all of the subsequent wiretap applications relied on the content of the conversations of those earlier recordings. It's our position that the statute that applies here is one that says that the evidence that is derived from the contents of these recorded conversations needs to be suppressed, and it's our position that the statute is plain when it says that it is the contents of the communication and the evidence derived therefrom.
What evidence was not suppressed that you think should be suppressed?
Every subsequent wiretap that was based on those contents of those conversations. So what happened in this case, Your Honor, was a set of recordings were made early on, and there was evidence obtained based on those contents. Those recordings and the contents of those recordings were utilized in subsequent wiretap applications and extensions. And they would extend it out over a significant period of time, significant amount of months that would be extended.
Are you talking about the application for the subsequent wiretaps, or are you talking about the evidence derived from those subsequent wiretaps?
Both, in the sense that the application, of course, was utilizing evidence obtained by the warrant, by the wiretap, to get
doesn't the statute permit that evidence to be used?
It permits the continued recording potentially at that stage. It would permit it. It would be at a later date, depending on when the sealing violation occurs, under whether or not the remedy would come into effect, which would be the question of whether that evidence was actually derived from the non-sealing, not just from the non-sealing, but from the actual recorded conversations.
And what is your understanding of the government's position with respect to whether any evidence derived was in fact introduced?
My understanding of the government's position is that one of the CDs or tapes in this case was not available and could not be located, and that the others were suppressed by them voluntarily, only to the extent of the actual conversations in those recordings and not any of the evidence derived therefrom from those recordings. So they read the statute to say that simply if the recordings themselves are suppressed of the non-sealed tapes, therefore they've followed the statute and no further remedy is necessary. I think that they also argue an argument that they had before the district court, that the district court did not accept, that they had a reasonable explanation for the non-sealing in this case. Our position is that, in fact, there was no explanation. I think the government's position I would characterize as no harm, no foul. They can't tell us what the foul is, really. They can't give an explanation. They can say what they believe it might have been, some kind of operator error, but they can't really tell us what it is. And they've defined the harm. They've said, okay, we're going to pick and choose these recordings and say, all right, these are the ones derived, therefore we're going to keep those out of evidence. That's all you have to worry about. And they don't take into account the actual statutory language, which talks about being derived from the contents of the communications, not just from the sealing violation. It would be akin to conducting a search of a residence, finding a VIN number plate in the residence. Let's say that search was illegal. You go out and you obtain a search warrant before there's a judicial determination of the fact that search was illegal, and then saying later at a court proceeding, well, you can't argue that whatever was obtained from the search warrant from the VIN number was tainted by that. in our common knowledge, we would be able to make that argument, and we would be able to say that that content, that finding of the VIN number, is something that could be, or that would taint a subsequent search of, say, a garage for that vehicle or something to that effect. In this case, it's the same thing. We're talking about the contents of the communications. The violation occurs. The contents are the sum and summation of that violation. Everything derived from there, at least directly derived, and in this case, there's really no question. Every time they apply and every time they get a warrant, they use the same phone calls
and keep going forward. The government is statutorily permitted to do that, and that's where this differs from a constitutionally based derivative evidence doctrine. This is a statutory interpretation issue, and there's an inherent tension in a broad interpretation of subsection 3 of 2517 in conjunction with 2518, and in terms of what the government is prohibited from doing, and subsections 1 and 2, which expressly permit the government to use the contents of these tapes, regardless of whether they were properly sealed.
I don't disagree that that tension exists, and that's the tension found by the Donlin Court and Fury to a lesser degree, but mostly by the Donlin Court. And I think that I argue in the brief, obviously, that I believe that tension is a little bit, I want to use the word manufactured, but that's not a fair word, but it's a little bit strong of a word to say that it's actually a tension. Because, one, we know we have Supreme Court cases that say that you're supposed to use the derived from analysis here. That's Gelbart. So we know that that's the analysis that we're supposed to use. The fact that the statute also allows them to utilize the non-sealed calls as they get warrants, as they go forward in the case, is simply a practical realization that investigations are ongoing, and especially the way government uses these wiretap cases now. These are on for months and months and months at a time. They're extremely complicated. There's a lot of interconnected circuitry, so to speak, as far as how they utilize evidence and obtain these warrants. And I don't know necessarily whether the statute contemplated that kind of continued and interconnected use.
Your view is that subsection 3 is the whole ballgame. Am I right?
I do, and I think there's a way they can solve the problem when they have it. If they have real probable cause from the very beginning, and they have a way to utilize and to develop it, they can do that independent. They can put a wall between the old prosecution once the violation occurs and the new prosecution. They didn't do that in this case. They used the same agents. They used the same prosecutor. They just basically said, okay, we're not going to use these calls. And to my mind, that's not sufficient.
Now, the district court, as I understand it, declined to address the question as to whether the government had a valid excuse for non-sealing. What was the district court's reason for not having reached that issue?
The stated reason was that the government voluntarily suppressed the evidence. I think the district court determined that the scope of her decision to determine what would be derived from evidence was already considered by the government and suppressed, and therefore they felt it was moot.
Now, if the district court had decided to reach that question, what would have been your reply?
If the court had made the decision in favor of the government, I assume.
No, if the government had said, I'm going to hear argument on the question of whether the government had a reasonable excuse for not having sealed the tapes, what would have been your reply?
In this case,
your position, I should say.
In this case, I would say the position would be somewhat what was taken by the trial attorney in the district court, which was simply that when the government says that they don't know what happened, and that's essentially what the government says, they think that it might have been operator error, but they don't know, that can't be a valid reason. It can't be a valid reason to say that we did something and we don't know what it is. So it can't be a valid excuse. You have to have an actual concrete reason for why it occurred. In this case, they speculate about some computer-based problem or some operator-related problem, but cannot in any way determine what that is. I think that to some extent, the standard of what the court has to consider hasn't quite caught up or doesn't quite match the technology or doesn't quite match what the government has at its disposal to make its determination of what happened. And that's another tension, to at least a factual tension, to my mind.
Now, does your argument apply not only to Mr. Martin, who you represent, but what about the some other defendants, Bell and Bay and so forth?
I have not looked closely at that aspect of it as far as what the evidence is, but I would assume that you are talking about evidence derived in the same manner, because obviously the tapes were the driving force of this case, and that, yes, it would apply to them as well.
Thank you.
Are there no further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, this morning I represent Mr. Jerome Terrell, Mr. Eddie Bell, and will be addressing the Confrontation Clause issues that apply also to Mr. Martin, as well as addressing any questions related to the other issues presented by my clients, Mr. Bell and Mr. Terrell. The first issue that I will address is the Confrontation Clause issue. In this case, the district court violated the Sixth Amendment of the defendants by completely preventing the jury from being presented with evidence that a government witness was being investigated for murder, had confessed to a murder, and may be trying to curry favor for that murder by giving his testimony for the government. The principal question that takes up most of the argument with respect to this matter is the question of whether that violation of the Sixth Amendment, whether that prohibition was a core violation of the Sixth Amendment or a peripheral one. If it was a core violation, the standard is de novo, the standard of review, and if it is a peripheral violation, the standard is abuse of discretion. And there's a real sense in which the resolution of the standard of review greatly impacts the ultimate outcome with respect to this issue. Now, in determining whether this is a core violation, what must be done is actually to consider the kind of evidence that was prevented from being presented to the jury. And what we had there was an entire reason for this witness to try to testify in favor of the government, curry favor, an entire reason for him to lie to help the government, essentially. That reason was completely distinct from his drug case and his plea agreement. He has a plea agreement in his federal drug case. He was questioned about that. But that's a wholly separate reason from a murder that he might have faced. And it's not as if he didn't know. He had been questioned about that murder. He had confessed to that murder, and that he was facing the possibility of a life sentence and looking for any way he might have to try to lessen that possibility and avoid a life sentence. This was perhaps the most profound sort of bias that there could be, a possible life sentence that this guy knew he was facing. He was taken to the state authorities by the federal authorities for whom he was testifying, and he, in his heart, there's no question that he may have hoped, and almost certainly did hope, that this would somehow impact this murder investigation and prevent him from being charged.
There's also a temporal issue here as well. This all occurred about the same time, am I right?
Yes, absolutely. He was arrested on the drug case by federal agents, and he was taken immediately by the federal agents to Maywood Police and interrogated immediately about the state murder. For him, these two things had to appear absolutely connected, regardless of whether they were or not. And it's his thoughts about this, his impression of what's going on, that mattered. And the jury was completely kept from knowing anything about it.
So you think this is a Davis and Alaska kind of situation?
It absolutely is, exactly like Davis versus Alaska or Lynn versus Murphy, which is one of the cases from this court. We had an entire reason for a witness to lie kept from a jury.
Now, there was a voir dire, the witness, and
yes,
the witness made it clear that he was going to take the Fifth, am I right?
The witness said that he wanted to take the Fifth. He did answer some questions about this, but took the Fifth with respect to others. And
with respect to, I'm sorry?
He took the Fifth with respect to some other questions. He wouldn't address the question of whether he did confess, what statement he made, anything like that. He didn't deny. I think he answered questions about, yes, he was taken there and he was being investigated. I think he admitted those things, but he was unwilling to give any substantive testimony about what he said or what his involvement was in this murder.
Was he unwilling to answer the question of whether he anticipated any favor because of his testimony in the incident?
He said that he didn't. He answered that one. And the problem, of course, is answered by Davis versus Alaska. We don't have to take the witness's word for it. The witness in Davis was asked, are you biased, essentially, and said, no, I'm not biased.
But surely there are limitations as to how far you ought to be able to go.
There are limitations, absolutely, with respect to how far you can go, but at the very least, as the De Leon case made clear, at the very least, what you have to be able to do is let the jury know what the issue was, and then have the jury, if the witness wants to say he didn't expect a benefit, let the jury see him answer those questions and know that it exists so they can evaluate his answers and his credibility on that issue.
Did the defense ever argue that he could give answer the questions they wanted to ask without violating his Fifth Amendment rights?
At the trial court level, Your Honor, I don't recall the defense making that specific argument. But the reality is the defense argued that he couldn't exercise his Fifth Amendment rights and argued that the questions they were asking should be put in front of the jury. The district court, what the district court ultimately did was allow the inquiry to be cut off when the witness took the Fifth Amendment after he said he didn't think he would receive a benefit. And the district court's procedure that the district court here used was problematic for two reasons. First, it's problematic because it prevents the jury from hearing about this at all. It completely shields the jury from an entire source for bias. The government has suggested that it's not a different source, but clearly it is. It's a completely separate, distinct issue from the plea agreement in the federal case.
If you had if your team had asked or had simply, are you expecting any favor from the government?
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the murder investigation you are currently currently a subject of in the state of Illinois, he could have answered that, could he have not, without violating his?
He could have, and he should have been able to in front of the jury.
But you never insisted he answer that question on the ground that he had no Fifth Amendment protection.
He did answer that question during the voir dire, and the attorneys at the trial level wanted to get those answers in front of the jury at least, but they also wanted to go farther. They said the Sixth Amendment inquiry wasn't over, and it's not. The witness's Fifth Amendment right doesn't trump the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses. There is no such case that indicates that it should. There's no balancing test in this circuit about the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment. If you have a core violation, which occurs when an entire subject, a reason for dishonesty, is kept from the jury, then the Fifth Amendment can't trump that. They have to answer that question. If the government wanted to put this witness on despite that, they could have given him immunity, as we argued in reply. There were mechanisms they could have used. They chose not to use those mechanisms, and instead they sort of wanted to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to put their witness on, and then when he said he didn't want to answer certain questions, they went to the core of the Sixth Amendment.
What was the focus of this voir dire proceeding that occurred when the issue came up? Was it really the end game question about whether there was an expectation of a benefit on the part of this witness in connection with the murder investigation, or was it more of a threshold, you know, relevance?
It was the government did not want this to go in front of the jury. The defense attorneys believed that this was, for the reasons we've stated here, an issue of bias that the jury was entitled to hear, and the court wanted to develop the nature of the bias. Now, when it got time to develop it, the Fifth Amendment became an issue.
Right, but I'm a little unclear about on what basis the district court's decision to exclude this line of questioning rested, whether it was completely on the Fifth Amendment invocation, whether it was on a conclusion that the witness's testimony that there was no expectation of a benefit sort of resolved the matter against admission of this line of questioning, or exactly what the basis was.
It is a bit vague, Your Honor, but what the district court indicated was, one, that the witness had taken the Fifth Amendment and could not be compelled to answer those additional questions. And
but
two,
the additional questions about the substance of the murder investigation really were beside the point, at least as far as...
Whether he confessed to the murder would have definitely been a question that's not beside the point, because that would have gone to the scope of his bias. His bias is created is much greater if he knows that he did it. He's already admitted to it, and he's got to find a way around it. So that Sixth Amendment would have required... It is our position that Sixth Amendment ultimately would have required him to answer that question. That's a core issue. But additionally, what the court focused on...
Your client's Sixth Amendment right would have trumped the witness's Fifth Amendment right?
My client's right would not have trumped it, but if they wanted to put that witness on, he has to answer. If the witness refuses to answer a core Sixth Amendment question, like the question of whether he confessed to the murder, then the decision is, do we strike his testimony because he refuses, or will the government give him immunity and allow this to go forward?
Or you would have moved for a mistrial.
Of course.
Okay.
That's absolutely right.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. How far did you want to go? I mean, how many questions did you, what exactly did you want to ask this witness?
The questions that needed to be asked the witness at the very minimum, I think, are these. Did the witness know there was a murder investigation? Was the witness transported directly by the authorities who had arrested him to the police who questioned him about the murder investigation? Did the witness answer questions about the murder investigation? Did the witness confess to committing the murder during that interrogation? And then following that question, he should have been asked, what did the witness hope that he would not be charged for that murder? Certainly the answer to that would have been yes. And then you can ask the question about whether the witness hoped that his assistance of the government might prevent him from being charged with the murder. And all of those are questions that should have been asked. The ultimate question of did he confess is one that definitely implicates his Fifth Amendment rights. The others really don't. And the court should have definitely permitted those questions to be asked in front of the jury, even if it was going to disallow the last one. I think that disallowance ultimately is a Sixth Amendment violation, too, and the other procedures such as immunity were necessary. But those questions had to be asked in front of the jury, and the refusal to allow that definitely is a violation, and a core one. The problem here is this, the procedure used by the court. The court allowed the inquiry to stop, essentially, when the witness said there was no benefit. The Fifth Amendment was an issue, but to get back to your previous question, Your Honor, the judge in the district court indicated that one of the issues predominantly was that this witness said there was no benefit, and that was important to the district court in allowing the Fifth Amendment to stop the inquiry. And Davis versus Alaska says that's just wrong. You can't do that. You can't let the witness answer the question, am I biased, in the negative, and then subsequent to that, not allow any further inquiry about what the nature of the bias might be. That's what happened in Davis, and the Supreme Court said you can't do that because the trier of fact, the jury, has to be able to see the facts underlying this source of bias, this murder investigation, find out what they are, and then, regardless of what the witness says, draw the inferences to determine whether the witness is telling the truth. When the court did that, when the district court allowed its procedure to prevent that to happen and allowed the witness's statement that he expected no benefit to be dispositive, it violated the Sixth Amendment and the ruling in Davis. And regardless of whether this is core or peripheral, that decision to allow that to happen was an abuse of discretion, too. You can't do that. That's simply what the law says. Had she would have either had to strike his testimony or compel the government to do something else in terms of making that testimony happen and having these questions answered. But when she didn't do that, and when she didn't even allow the questions that wouldn't have implicated the Fifth Amendment to be presented in front of the jury, she both abused her discretion and violated the Sixth Amendment in a core way.
Was it necessary for your side to ask the witness whether he had confessed to the murder?
Pursuant to the Sixth Amendment requirement, I think it was. Because in order to develop his bias, the jury needed to know that he did it, he admitted it, so they knew that he did it, and his desperate need to avoid the prosecution was greater because he confessed. So that was an essential element. Moreover, the witness had reason to believe that this was not able to be examined either, but the witness had reason to believe that he might get a benefit on this, because the language of his plea agreement actually referenced state investigations and possible cooperation with respect to those. The other, as indicated, we gave an example from another plea agreement. The other plea agreements here didn't implicate the state. And so if this witness read his plea agreement, whether or not the government subjectively intended to do anything for him, he had reason to believe that he might be able to help himself here. And the other thing to think about is with respect to this kind of motive evidence, motive to fabricate, what he had was one plea agreement in which he knew what it was going to be. It was going to be a six and a half years, I think, reduction. That's one reason that he might want to lie. But the other one is far more compelling. The desire to avoid a potential life sentence, that's far more compelling. And that's the one that was prevented. any time you have a situation where the evidence that's excluded, the source of bias that's excluded, is more compelling than the source that's presented, you have a core violation. But in addition to that, if you think about how it works, the witness was on the stand and he was hoping, if the jury would have been allowed to draw inference about this, but if he was hoping that he could avoid this murder, which was not specifically addressed in his plea agreement, then his desire to do even better for the government and to be even better, it would be greater, because he's trying to get an additional benefit by being so good. And that is a completely different kind of bias, which was not explored at all.
What ultimately is the prejudice here? Because this witness, Rudy Taylor, was one of many cooperating co-conspirators who testified, as I understand it.
Absolutely. And with respect to that, the harmless error analysis applies here. Now, in order to do the harmless error analysis pursuant to the Supreme Court's ruling in Von Arsdale, what we have to do is we have to assume that had the excluded questions been asked, we must assume that they had their maximal damaging effect. And once we make that presumption, determine if that had happened, the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt the verdict would have been the same. And that's simply not possible in this case with respect to these defendants. And the reason it's not is, with respect to Mr. Taylor, what that amounts to is saying the question about the murder were asked, and if you resolve those such that the full damaging impact is fully realized, then it's the case that he is essentially, the jury will conclude that he's lying. Or that he's willing to lie, which means they'll have to disregard his testimony. So to do this in light of this kind of core violation, you have to say, what would the government have been able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that defendants were guilty had his testimony not existed at all? Because it would essentially have been disregarded. And the answer to that is no. What the government didn't do in its response brief was present the harmless error analysis in the context of the individual defenses presented. Mr. Terrell's individual defense was a multiple conspiracy defense. And the only real evidence of regularity of connection between him and Troy Martin, the best evidence, came from two witnesses, Rudy Taylor and Donnell Simmons.
Are you the designator here on the instructional problem on the conspiracy?
Yes, I am. Yes.
How did the Sixth Circuit instruction that you tendered comport with the law of this circuit, that there in fact can be a conspiracy within a conspiracy?
The Sixth Circuit instruction did not indicate that participation in a subset of the same conspiracy would result in the finding of not guilty. That's just not in the language. And the other conspiracy instructions proved and suggested to the jury that that wasn't appropriate.
Why is that?
Because the other instructions make very clear that if you have a conspiracy, you don't have to be a part of the entire conspiracy. You don't have to know about all of the conspiracy. And so when you put all those instructions together, they make it apparent that if you're part of any section of this conspiracy, any subset, you're guilty.
Where in the record am I going to find, in their totality, the instructions that were given in this case?
The instructions, the final jury instructions, should be in the record. I don't know exactly what the record number would be, but they should be there.
I'm having trouble finding those. So you might want to check with the clerk's office.
Well, we'll do that, Your Honor. We will do that. To come back to the harmless error analysis, however, Mr. Terrell's situation was such that there's only Simmons and Rudy Taylor giving this connection to Troy Martin that's substantial. The problem is that both of them are cooperators with significant credibility problems. If you take out Rudy Taylor, there's no way that the government can possibly say, as a matter of logic, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the jury would have credited Simmons if Taylor's testimony of corroboration was removed. It may be the corroboration that made the jury find guilt. And the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that wasn't the case. Not for Mr. Terrell or Mr. Bell. With respect to Mr. Bell, Rudy Taylor provided the one crucial piece of information that was this. He's the only witness that said, if you were a member of Mafia Insane and you were a drug dealer, your drug dealing had to be for Mafia Insane. That's how the gang worked. He was the only person that provided that, and that was crucial to a finding that Eddie Bell, his drug dealing, was part of the Mafia Insane's drug dealing. Two other points I'd like to make briefly. There was some argument of waiver with respect to Mr. Terrell, which seems wholly inappropriate here. Mr. Terrell's lawyer, when the court referenced its prior ruling, Mr. Terrell's lawyer said that they wanted to do a voir dire and then argued the Fifth Amendment was inappropriate, so there was no waiver. This issue was preserved. And then finally, with respect to Mr. Bell and the issue of his Kimbrough full remand, this Court's found that drug-type arguments indicate that a defendant is absolutely commenting on the disparity and preserves the disparity issue for a full remand. Bell asked specifically for the November 2007 guidelines, which the Commission created to deal with the disparity. So in doing so, he preserved that issue, and he's entitled to a full Kimbrough remand. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Fulton.
May it please the Court. The District Court here granted the motion to suppress the late sealed wiretap recordings based on the government's agreement that it would not use the wiretaps or the evidence obtained during those wiretaps, those periods of interception that later turned out not to be sealed proper or in time. And based on that agreement, the District Court denied the motion to suppress. The District Court properly did that and properly did not go beyond that to suppress evidence that may have been, for example, the extensions of the wiretaps that utilized in part the evidence obtained during the previous wiretap periods.
So your representation is that you did not use evidence on those tapes or evidence derived therefrom, am I correct?
Other than the... That's correct, Judge. The evidence that the government agreed not to use and was not used at trial included any recordings that were made during those periods of interception, any transcripts that were made of recordings or overhears that were made during those periods of interception, any drugs seized based on conversations that were intercepted during those periods. Those periods of interception and any conversations that were monitored during those periods were not used as a basis for any search warrant, for any complaint, or not presented to the grand jury. So in that respect, the government voluntarily suppressed everything that was obtained from those periods of interception.
Are you, if I listened correctly, it'd be still be the possibility that you had other sorts of evidence you were able to develop because of those tapes?
Well, my opponents argue that the extensions of the wiretaps that were obtained during the course of the investigation, which lasted almost a – well, the wiretap period lasted almost a year, that those were derived from the late-sealed wiretaps and must be suppressed. We think that that's not warranted, though, by the statute, because the statute explicitly allows for extensions prior to the prior to any sealing obligation coming into effect. The sealing obligation only comes into effect when the wiretap and any extensions thereof finally expire.
Application for an extension would normally be controlled by subsection 3, would it not? It's a judicial proceeding.
Well, I don't believe so, Judge, because subsection 3 requires that any use of the wiretap is premised upon a proper sealing. And, of course, an extension can be made before sealing is required. So I don't think subsection 3 is governed by the sealing requirements. So in that regard, the extensions of the wiretaps cannot be evidence derived from the – in other words, it was not required for the District Court to suppress the extensions of the wiretaps based on the later sealing problems.
Is your position dependent on the Second Circuit's decision?
It's dependent on a reading of the statute, and the Second Circuit's two cases, we think, explain our reading of the statute, and we think that they're persuasive authority. Right.
Now, do you have the same understanding as your colleague with respect to why the District Court declined to take what seems to be the easiest way to deal with this matter of simply deciding whether or not the excuse you gave for non-sealing was satisfactory?
Right. The district court didn't reach that ground. We urged it to do so, and we think that if the district court had reached it, she would have agreed with us. But I do agree with my opponent that the reason she didn't reach that ground was that she thought that the government's agreement not to use this evidence covered the board, basically, of what would have been required had there been no satisfactory explanation. We think that there was a satisfactory explanation here. Now, and that's the other reason to affirm
this. If we decided not to get into this, get ourselves tanglefoot in this situation, decided to, on a limited, really the easiest way to decide this case was on the question of whether your explanation was satisfactory. Are there issues of fact that the district court would have to confront on that issue if we were to remand it to her?
No, Your Honor. There was a lengthy hearing that took place before the district court on this very issue. And the case agent, Agent Konovalenka, testified about what had happened during the course of the investigation, how the sealing problem was discovered, what their investigation into the problem revealed, and what the government did about it once it learned that there had been this problem. All those issues were fleshed out. There really wasn't a dispute of fact about what happened or why the government learned about it late or so on. And, in fact, there really was no suggestion here that there was any tampering involved. The government offered a good faith basis for its delay in sealing in those. Now, remember that there were three periods of interception involved here, and every other period of interception was timely sealed. But for its late sealing of those periods of interception, the government offered a good faith explanation of why the delay had occurred in circumstances that dispelled any possible suspicion that there had been tampering involved. There was basically the reason for the delay was that the government thought that what it had sealed during the course of the ongoing wiretaps and extensions thereof, the government thought that what it had sealed, the disk that it had sealed, contained the recordings that they should have contained.
Could we resolve the question of the whether your explanation was satisfactory at this level?
I'm sorry?
Could we decide at this level that whether your explanation for the non-sealing was satisfactory?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the facts in the record are sufficient to support our argument. It was fully presented below. We urged it as a ground for affirmance, and the court can affirm on any ground that is supported in the record like this. So we think that that would take care of the issue, and that the district court's order granting the motion to suppress as far as it went, that is the government's agreement, but refusing to suppress anything further should be affirmed.
How does that square with the Coney case that says this is a factual determination that is made by the district court and we defer, and there was no such determination made here about whether the explanation was satisfactory?
All of the facts that would support the conclusion that it was that the explanation was satisfactory have been laid out in the record. And I think what I would say is that the conclusion that those facts amount to a satisfactory explanation is sort of a legal conclusion.
Well, that requires some tweaking of Coney, I would think, which said it's not a legal determination, it's a factual determination. Are you proposing that we do that?
Well,
recharacterize this as a mixed question of fact and law?
Right. I think that's what I'm saying, yeah. So, with regard to the, unless there are other questions about the suppression issue, I
just need a clarification on your position and the district court's decision here and what it actually amounted to. Does your position in the district court's decision amount to a conclusion or a holding that the evidence obtained from the extensions of the intercepts that were obtained from the late sealed working disks simply doesn't qualify as derivative evidence under the statute, and therefore there's no issue? Is that a proper characterization of your argument?
I think that is. I think that is. I think that's what the district court was required to hold when it found that no further suppression was warranted. That's right.
But what justifies that sort of line drawing?
Well, I guess it's the structure of the 2517, 1, 2, and 3, and when the sealing obligation comes into play. Because it doesn't come into play when extensions are sought.
Right, but the original time periods for the intercepts had expired at the time the error was discovered. Isn't that right? Or is that not right? Were the errors discovered within the confines of the original intercept time period, or had those time periods expired?
That time period had expired. The Target Phone 2, which was the Troy Martin phone, was intercepted with one extension after the other from January to September of 2003. And the problem with the sealing, and terminated on September 9th, I believe. The problem with the sealing was discovered around October 14th, basically. And the steps to seal what had, and I'm sorry, let me step back. And at the end of every 30-day period during that time, the government had been sealing what it thought contained, was a disk that it thought contained all of the conversations that had been intercepted during that 30 days. After October 14th, when the problem was discovered, the government went back and found that three periods of interception didn't have what they should have had. It took steps at that point to seal those three periods of interception. So I guess what I'm saying is that those extensions that had taken place during the course of that year or 9 months were authorized under the statute, and this later sealing problem doesn't require that they be suppressed because no sealing was required to get the extension. Does that make sense?
Well, I think so, but it's not really it's not really an argument then that this evidence is not derivative, because it is as a factual matter, isn't it?
Well, we don't read 2517 the derived from to be as broad as that, is what I'm saying. Is the derived from should be limited to the interceptions, transcripts, summaries, use in, for example, search warrants, grand jury, and so on. The derived from can't mean the use in later extensions, because otherwise the statute would require undoing of an entire investigation based on the sealing problem of, say, one period of interception.
But there is agreement that the contents of the late sealed working disks were used to obtain later extensions in these various rolling wiretaps.
They were contained in, some of those conversations were contained in the application for an extension. Now, one position that we did advance below as well is that the extension applications contained, if you disregarded the conversations that were related from the periods that had sealing problems, applications for extensions had their own probable cause even without regard to those. That they stood on their own and could be affirmed without considering the late sealed wiretap conversations. Now, the district court didn't reach that ground, but we think it's there, that there was probable cause for those extension applications even excluding the contents of the late seal card. With regard to the Confrontation Clause argument, my opponent today insists that what was required is that Mr. Taylor be required to answer whether he confessed to the murder. They were insisting on that in the district court, and they insist on that today. And the district court here did not abuse her discretion, in ruling this out of bounds.
Well, she didn't just exclude that line of questioning. She excluded the entire line of questioning about the state court murder. Right?
Right. Although I don't believe that the defendants in the district court argued that they should be allowed, as Judge Ripple was asking, just to ask only whether there had been an investigation and whether he had received the benefit. They insisted on going that extra step.
Well, I understand that, but the court didn't have to use an all or nothing approach, and the court used a nothing approach here. In other words, you don't get anything out of this witness regarding possible bias stemming from an expectation of a benefit from the testimony in the state murder prosecution.
You're right. She did not take that approach. Now, she concluded, though, that this subject, given that there was no evidence that Mr. Taylor, Rudy Taylor, expected a benefit from his federal cooperation on the state murder investigation, would be a cause for, I believe that she concluded it would be a cause for her, would cause confusion among the jury, it would violate his Fifth Amendment right, and it was a collateral matter to the drug case. Collateral in the sense that the murder had nothing to do with the drug charges.
Well, that may be true as a factual matter, but the question here is whether it was a source of bias, which turns on the question of whether the jury could infer that he expected a benefit for his testimony in connection with the murder investigation. And given the expansive language of the plea agreement, which is susceptible to an interpretation that he expected a benefit in state prosecutions as well as federal, that's a jury question, not a court question.
Your Honor, though, I think that his plea agreement, which does call for him to cooperate in the federal and state investigations, makes it clear that his only benefit would be in the federal case, because the plea agreement provides that this plea agreement resolves only his liability in that federal case. And in fact, there's language that says the agreement is limited to the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois and cannot bind any other federal, state, or local prosecuting authority. So the plea agreement doesn't provide a basis for thinking that Mr. Taylor's denial of expectation of benefit was somehow untruthful. The plea agreement is confined to the federal case.
Well, correct. I mean, the federal government can't give away the state's rights as against a murder suspect. So that's very clear. But the question is whether there was some expectation that his cooperation in the federal investigation would be made known by the feds to the state prosecutors, and that he might there have a subjective expectation of bias. And the fact that he denies it, it doesn't take the question from the jury. The case law stands for the proposition that the jury is entitled to make that judgment. And it's unclear to me exactly on what basis the district court rested its ruling here, whether it was a substantive evidentiary call, whether it was based on the Fifth Amendment, whether it was based on this idea that this is somehow wholly collateral. It was a little vague.
You're right. It was a little vague, and the district court didn't explain it as well as it might have. But I think there are a variety of grounds for affirming the decision. One is that the Sixth Amendment right doesn't extend to this type of collateral matter, that is, the murder.
But the cases don't support that.
Well, the bias of Mr. Taylor was available for cross-examination, and they fully exploited that.
As to one source of bias, but
right.
There were multiple sources of bias here.
There was no basis for suggesting that there was a basis.
That's for the jury, not the court.
Well,
the jury decides whether to accept the witness's protest that he doesn't expect or doesn't harbor any subjective expectation. At least that's how I understand the case law.
Well, at any rate, even if it could be said that the district court erred in excluding, in prohibiting, prescribing this line of cross-examination, we don't think it was, we think it was harmless. And certainly Mr. Taylor's evidence was not critical to the government's case in either the Bell and Martin trial or in the Terrell trial. Rudy Taylor was one of, in the Bell and Martin trial, he was one of 12 cooperating witnesses. And, of course, the critical evidence against Bell, Martin, and the other defendants at trial were the wiretaps, the recordings of the defendants committing the crime as it took place in real time. Mr. Taylor, his evidence or his testimony in that trial was a minor increment in addition to what all of the government's other evidence, the critical piece of evidence being, of course, the wiretap.
How about with respect to Mr. Terrell?
Mr. Terrell as well. Mr. Rudy Taylor was one of 5 cooperating defendants in that case. There were some 47 or approximately 50 wiretap recordings that were played at the Terrell trial. And Taylor's evidence was really not central to the government's case against Mr. Terrell.
Was it central to the issue of whether Mr. Terrell had his own little show going and wasn't part of a major conspiracy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Mr. Terrell's multiple conspiracy argument centered, and the instruction that he proposed centered on the conspiracy that he contended, the sort of subset or lesser conspiracy that he contended he was involved in, that is one between himself and Christopher Clark.
He doesn't say it's a subset. He says it's a separate conspiracy.
A separate conspiracy. He characterized it as a separate conspiracy. The Christopher Clark, Jerome Terrell involvement, though, was wholly apart from Rudy Taylor's testimony and was, in fact, dependent on the testimony of Christopher Clark. He was a cooperating witness who testified at the Terrell trial and on the wiretaps, as well as the testimony of Donnell Simmons and other cooperators. Christopher Clark was Jerome Terrell's worker in this drug case. Clark testified at trial about how he delivered drugs for Terrell to the others, Terrell's dealings with the others, and so on. The Rudy Taylor testimony really didn't have much to do with that. So we think that even in the Terrell trial, Taylor's testimony, if there were error in limiting the cross-examination,
your view is that Rudy's testimony was pure surplus this trial.
That, yes, basically. Obviously, there was some benefit for the government to introduce the testimony. Otherwise, we wouldn't have. But any limitation on cross-examination was harmless. With regard to the multiple conspiracy instruction, Your Honor asked where the court could find the final instructions that were in fact given at the trial. And I think probably the best source for finding them is at the last volume of the trial transcript, where, of course, the court reporter writes down what the district court, how the district court instructed the jury. And that that should be in the record.
I had a question about that. The defense tendered the Sixth Circuit instruction. So I understand it, you're unhappy with that because it doesn't make clear in and of itself, at least, that a sub-conspiracy within the charge conspiracy is sufficient for the government to prevail. But you didn't tender any amendment to that Sixth Circuit instruction. I mean, was it really their responsibility to tender an instruction on to cover a fact situation which the defense says didn't exist? They say there is no conspiracy within a conspiracy. Well, their view is that there were two conspiracies. But, I mean, the prosecutor sat there and didn't do anything. Is that really chargeable to the defense?
Well, I guess the district court concluded, Your Honor, and that the jury instruction conference is included in the transcript, that last volume of the trial transcript. The district court concluded that what Mr. Terrell was getting at was covered by the conspiracy instruction that was in fact given. The instruction that Mr. Terrell was arguing for, the one that he proposed, did contain the language that the government must convince you that the defendant was a member of the conspiracy charging indictment. If the government fails to prove this, then you must find defendant not guilty of the conspiracy charge, even if you find he was a member of some other conspiracy. So it was a combination of that language, which the cases have disapproved of, as well as the fact that the instruction tendered by Mr. Terrell in a way verged on an admission of guilt by him, because he, in the instruction he tendered, offered that the separate conspiracy he was in fact involved in was the Terrell-Clark conspiracy, one that was in fact embraced by the language of the indictment. And if the district court had given that instruction, I think that the record of the jury instruction conference bears out that the district court was concerned that that was in fact tantamount to, well, it went a long way towards establishing Mr. Terrell's guilt, put it that way. Because, in fact, under the law, the Terrell-Clark conspiracy, if it was a subset of the charged conspiracy, and if he was trying to rely on that in his separate conspiracy instruction, that, in fact, would not have helped him at all. So the district court refused this offered instruction and instead relied on straight-up elements of the conspiracy instruction.
But there was some evidence to support Mr. Terrell's theory, was there not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
There was some evidence to support Mr. Terrell's theory of two separate conspiracies with, at best, a buyer-seller relationship between them.
Well, I think I can answer that two ways, Judge. Mr. Terrell's buyer-seller argument went towards his dealings with Donnell Simmons, Mario Taylor, and other members, conceded members of the Mafia Insane Vice Lord conspiracy charged in count one of the indictment. He said, as to them, I only have a buyer-seller relationship. His evidence, his argument that he was engaged in a separate conspiracy, went to his involvement with Christopher Clark. And that was the subject of the instruction that he offered. In fact, though, Christopher Clark was also a member of the conspiracy charge in count one, and his testimony made it clear that his dealings with Terrell had to do with the conspiracy charge in count one. The argument offered in his brief that Terrell's separate conspiracy really had to do with his drug spot at Laverne and Huron or some other spot on the west side, that was really not the one advanced by Mr. Terrell in his instruction offered to the district court or in his closing argument. The closing argument that Mr. Terrell advanced at trial had to do with the fact that he wasn't a mafia insane, that he didn't pay street tax to Troy Martin, that he only dealt with Clark. He was a drug dealer, but he was only in a buyer-seller relationship with these other men, and that he had not, in fact, entered the conspiracy as required for under the instructions offered by the district court. With regard to the so unless there are any further questions on the jury instruction issue, I'd like to talk about the briefly about the issue of the remand. And on that score, the record of Eddie Bell's sentencing makes clear that Mr. Bell did not argue the Kimbrough issue at all. In fact, it was the government that made clear that because Mr. Bell was being sentenced on, I believe it was November 1st, 2007, that he was entitled to the benefit of the reduced guideline for crack. It went from his crack guideline offense level went from a level 38 to a level 36, and there was not a word spoken by Mr. Bell with regard to that change in the law, and he certainly didn't argue in any way that he sought to preserve an argument based on the disparity in the statute between crack and powder, and that therefore there's no ground for this court to find that he did not forfeit that argument. We'd ask that the judgment and sentences of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rowland, how much time?
I just want to respond to a couple of the issues raised by the government and some of the questions raised by the court. I think that the issue about 2518.8a and the subsection 3 of the component statute, there was no reason for Congress to write into that derivative evidence, where there was a derivative evidence ban on the use by the agents in the course of their duties. Because, as Your Honors know, and as Congress well knew, derivative evidence questions are resolved at court. That is, they're not resolved by the agents on the street as they're going forward. So to ask the question about whether 2518.8a's derivative evidence ban doesn't apply to subsections 1 and 2, it's not a question of Congress making its point clear that it didn't want it to happen that way. It's simply an acknowledgement of the way the exclusionary rule works. In this question, the Supreme Court has already said they're importing essentially the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule analysis into the statute, and this is how we do it.
Well, subsection 1 and 2 of 2517 use the same language, though.
They use it slightly differently, though, in the sense of who's utilizing the evidence. That is, it's the agents as they or the individual investigators. I'm missing the exact word at this moment.
But they both refer to evidence derived therefrom, meaning from the contents of the intercepts.
Correct. And then it's subsection 3 that says you cannot use it in the state or federal proceeding.
Right.
And so I think our point is there that the intention, when they say that they don't want to derive from and use in that proceeding, is expecting it to not be decided or not to be considered until it gets to court. Obviously, the constitutional obligation applies, but I think it's a practical matter. We know when it's actually sorted out. The other question that Your Honor raised was the question of the factual findings and the question about whether there was a satisfactory explanation in the record. The government did choose to have an agent testify about this, not a technician. They have not offered a particular explanation for what occurred, and I think that even though the record was developed to some degree, and they may accept that development as being satisfactory, it does offer no explanation. They did not choose to utilize a technician or some other individual that maybe some more expertise could actually explain what the error was here. They simply ended up saying that they couldn't do that. And if there are no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brindley.
With respect to the question about Mr. Terrell and the harmless error, what Mr. Fullerton referred to was all the information provided by Christopher Clark. That's why this has to be considered in the context of his defense of separate conspiracies. Everything about Christopher Clark was argued by Mr. Terrell to be the separate conspiracy. So Mr. Clark couldn't establish the link that was necessary on his own. The only way that they established the regularly and continuous link between Martin conspiracy and Mr. Terrell came from the corroborative combination of Simmons and Rudy Taylor. And as I stated, there is no way in the world the government could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that without the corroboration of Taylor that Simmons would have been credited. It's not, we don't have to prove that Mr. Terrell would have been acquitted based on that. That's not the harmless error standard. We have to prove that when Taylor's testimony is taken out, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it would be the same outcome. And when the corroborate two, both of them have credibility problems, both of them are cooperating witnesses who have to be viewed with caution and great care. When that happens, it can't be the case that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt ever that when one of the corroboration witnesses is taken out and there is no longer corroboration, that the verdict would remain the same. The additional question about whether Mr. Terrell had offered any evidence to show separate conspiracy, the answer to that is yes. He did offer evidence that he was not a mafia insane. He did offer evidence that he didn't pay his street tax, and he did offer evidence and argument that what he did with Christopher Clark was actually a competitive situation, that he was a competitor for Mr. Martin. So the multiple conspiracy instruction should have been given. If there are no further questions, I thank you.
The court wished to extend our thanks to those of you who served as appointed counsel in this case, and the case will be taken under advisement, and then we'll move to the second case.